Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
What will it take to save honeybees? And what does their struggle and decline tell us about us? We are going to talk about the plight of the honeybee this hour with the author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest will talk about the fallout from colony collapse disorder, the synergy he thinks is behind it, and what lessons bees can offer humans. And we'll welcome your questions and your concerns at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Mark Winston is a bee biologist. He's been a bee biologist for more than 40 years. He was the founding director of Simon Fraser University's Center for Dialogue in British Columbia, Canada. Author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what got you involved in bee research?
Well, when I was young, I was looking for tropical adventures, and I had just started a graduate program at the University of Kansas, and my advisor had just gotten a grant to study killer bees in South America, and I heard the South America part, thought bees would do just fine, and found myself in the jungles of French Guiana studying bees in 1976.
Wow, and you've been doing it a long time. Pretty worried about our bees these days?
I am worried. I'm worried about honeybees. I'm worried about wild bees. I've never seen in my career, I've never seen a period in which bees were so threatened. And I think the threats that they're facing are the canary in the mine for us. And there's a lot to learn from the tragedy of bee loss and the possibilities of what we can do to resurrect bee populations.
All right, well, let's just bring us up to date. What do we know about the recent decline in bee populations? What is happening?
Well, with the honeybees, it's been going on for probably close to 10 years now. It started as what we called colony collapse disorder, when beekeepers would just show up at their hives and the hives would be gone. But we're not seeing that much anymore, but we're still seeing losses of about a third of every American bee colony every year. And we have a fairly good idea of what's causing it, and it's not any one single factor. It's a plethora of things, an interaction. You could call it the perfect storm of bee deaths, in which nutritional issues coming from not a lot of forage for bees, not a lot of nectar and pollen outside of cropland. It comes from pesticide use, both by beekeepers inside their hives and by farmers outside. And it comes from the interaction of these factors with a number of pests and diseases, which all are synergizing each other, creating a situation where 1 + 1 equals considerably more than 2.
Yeah. Well, I didn't hear pesticides in that list of threats. Is that a part of this?
Pesticides are a major part of it, but probably not in the way that people expect. We know about pesticides that just outright kill bees. And the way those are used is fairly well regulated. But in the last number of years, we've discovered that there are probably anywhere between 10 and 30 or 40 pesticides found in every honeybee colony. And they're there at low levels. And if you look at any one of those pesticides, it's at a level that regulators think will not harm bees. But yet we're finding that the combination of a numbers of pesticides together, each acting at a low level that itself wouldn't cause a problem, becomes cumulative and additive and eventually synergistic. And the way they're acting is primarily by affecting the bees' immune systems so that bees are much less resistant to diseases and pests. Mm. And then so it's a combination of pesticide and then a disease that ends up killing bees. And the fascinating thing about that for us is we, too, are exposed to probably considerably more pesticides. And if you look at all the chemicals that we're exposed to, you know, hundreds of thousands of chemicals at very low levels, each one which the regulators tell us they're safe for us, yet we have no idea how they're interacting in our system. And there's so many hints in human health that they might be having an issue. We might be having issues, problems with autoimmune system, things like the onset of autism, just many aspects of cancers, and just things that we don't really have a very good handle on in terms of their epidemiology. And what the bees are telling us is that we need to study these issues in humans, because in the bees, in the bee model system, it's now pretty clear that there's lots of problems going on with multiple effects of multiple pesticides at low levels.
So that's why you're calling them the canary in the coal mine.
Very much. Bees are environmental gatherers. They go out and they sample the entire environment for many miles around the hive as they forage for nectar and pollen. And so when they come back to the hive and they're having issues, it's telling us that there's some low-level contaminants in the environment that have built up to a point where they're starting to have significant impact.
Yeah. Oh, so I wanted to ask you, though, if we're not seeing total colony collapse anymore, but still significant declines, deaths of honeybees, with a third of the hives dying off each year. I mean, that's still scary, but if we're not seeing total colony collapse anymore, does that mean that we're arriving at some answers here?
Well, no. I'd say we're arriving at answers in terms of what we know the problem is. We are not taking the actions that are necessary to minimize the problem. In Wisconsin, is a dairy state. And can you imagine if dairy farmers were losing one-third of their dairy cattle every year? It would be considered a huge tragedy. And yet, because bees are below most people's radar, and they're not the cute, fuzzy kind of megafauna animal that some of our cattle might be, we're not dealing with the issue with the kind of intensity and the kind of really well-coordinated response that we usually would do if we had an agricultural disaster of this magnitude.
So what needs to be done? How do we save the bees?
Well, there's a whole range of things. They mostly involve, the most immediate things we can do are to preserve and enhance habitats for bees. The things, farmers have become incredibly adept at eliminating weeds, particularly in genetically modified crop systems, in which they're able to manage weeds, so there's nary a weed in the field. And we have these huge monocrop acreages in which only one thing is grown. And the consequence of that for bees is that there's only one nutritional source out there. And that's a big problem. You can imagine going into the supermarket and having nothing but bananas to eat. That's kind of what bees are facing out in the landscape. And when you couple that with the habitat degradation that comes from pesticide use, and having many, many contaminants out in the field that our bees are bringing back to the hive, that's a problem. So the solutions are really fairly simple, fairly direct, and they would be pretty helpful for all agriculture. One is to diversify agriculture, to take advantage of the beneficial organisms that are out there by creating much more diverse habitats in which honeybees can thrive, wild bees can live, and many parasites and predators and pests would do well. And the second thing we need to do is reduce pesticide use. We overuse pesticides to an extent in the United States that's staggering. There's over 1 billion pounds of pesticides used in the United States every year. That's something like 3 or 3.5 pounds of pesticides for every man, woman, and child in the country. That's a lot of chemical use. And most of it is unnecessary. We use pesticides way too quickly and way too intensely and way too high doses and way too often. And as a result, we've created a whole range of resistant pests. So it's not really good for agriculture in general and certainly not good for bees.
Yeah,
so those two things would really make a big difference.
I would imagine that, Wisconsin's dairy industry would be outraged if a third of that industry was wiped out. But you would think that we have a lot of agriculture in Wisconsin, and the the honeybee is critical to a lot of that agriculture, isn't it? In terms of we wouldn't be growing a lot of crops if it weren't for the honeybee.
Absolutely. And farmers are starting to get concerned, particularly in areas where honeybees have become essential. The other problem with bees is the fact that honeybees have become essential. There are many, many species of wild bees which could be pollinating our crops if farmers were conserving and enhancing the habitats that wild bees need in order to survive. And I think it's a mistake to focus only on honeybees. They're a good pollinator, and they're managed, and they're useful. But the wild bees are also doing poorly. And if we were managing our habitats better, they would be a on-site and permanent source of pollination that would reduce our dependence on unmanaged honeybees.
So what's the difference between the honeybee and wild bees?
Well, most wild bees are solitary. Some are social, like bumblebees and small hives. Wild bees nest in the ground. They nest in twigs and little hollows behind bark and places like that. And, before mass agriculture took over, wild bees would be found quite diverse and quite diverse and abundant. They'd be quite diverse and abundant in most habitats. Oddly, probably the best populations of wild bees are now found in cities rather than in the country, because in cities there's reduced pesticide use and cities have very diverse habitats in which bees can thrive. I think that's something that farmers, agriculture, can learn from urban environments.
The wild bees are I always call them the big, the bumblebees and other bees, not the hornets, though.
Not the hornets. No, wasps are, hornets and wasps, which are the same thing, are completely different. They mostly don't pollinate plants, whereas they're scavengers, they're predators, whereas bees exist completely on nectar and pollen as their food sources. Many of the wild bees are the big ones, the big bumblebees you see, but there are also a lot of very small ones. And it's that range of sizes that's so important for agriculture, because flowers are quite different. And having a range that can pollinate many different types of flowers is a very healthy environmental service.
So the same types of diversify agriculture and reduce pesticide use will save the wild bees too?
Absolutely. It's absolutely critical for wild bees. With pesticides, at least honeybees, you can move the bees away from the crop if the farmer is going to spray something noxious. But wild bees live there. That's where they nest, and they have nowhere else to go. And so it's particularly critical that we reduce pesticide use and create bee-friendly habitats for wild bees.
Yeah, and maybe give us a scope of how critical this is. If we don't save the honeybee and we don't save the wild bee, what happens?
Well, we're heading towards an unparalleled disaster. Right now we're in a holding pattern, but unless we change practices, it's going to start taking another nosedive. Probably about a third of our food is dependent on bee pollination. That's just untold billions of dollars of agricultural production. And that doesn't even begin to say anything about the natural habitats, in which the survival of most habitats that we're aware of, at least most terrestrial habitats, are dependent on having bees pollinate plants, in which that's how the plants reproduce. So, we're looking at a disaster of unprecedented agricultural and natural proportions if we don't do something to reverse this trend for bees.
We are talking with Mark Winston, a bee biologist and author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. And we're talking about what we can learn from bees. And we are welcoming your questions about the decline in bee populations and what we can do to save our honeybees and wild bees, and how important this is. And we'll talk about other lessons, too, that we can learn from bees. welcoming your questions and concerns at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the plight of the honeybee and other wild bees with a guest who says we should be concerned not only for the bees, but for ourselves. We are talking with the author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. And we're welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to the phones, and our first caller is Michael in Richland Center. Hello, Michael.
Yes, hello. Yes, one of the things that I've noticed is that the bee is one of the things in Scripture that shows a spiritual connection to the spirituality of man, if you will, because the word for bee is Deborah, or you get the word Deborah or for a name as well. And one of the things that the Scripture does say is that in the end of days, there will be a famine of the devar, or the word, and the bee is sweet, and it's a depiction of the word being sweet to our souls. So what is happening is the physical depicts a spiritual application, just like, you know, why is the honeybee dying out because of GMOs or pesticides and all these other things is because it's the same with the spiritual things of man has been polluted with all this other garbage in his life, and there is no word in the word of Elohim in him or word of God in him. So That's just one of the things I wanted to make a comment on.
Well, I don't know if you have any comment on the religious nature of the honeybee or what messages we can take along those lines, Mark Winston.
Well, I think we read a lot into honeybees that, from their point of view, probably isn't there, but it creates a beautiful metaphor and model for us in thinking about how we exist in the world. One of the chapters in my book is about spirituality and about the deep sense of collaboration and collegiality and working together that bees provide for us. There is some magical essence about a beehive. It's interesting when you talk to beekeepers about what it's really like to go into their bees and to walk into the apiary on a nice day and to feel the sun and to open the hive and have yourself feel in tune with the bees and very present. It's a very spiritual moment. I imagine it's quite similar to how people feel praying and various institutions of worship.
Yeah.
So I think there is something mystical and magical about the bees that helps to connect us to a deeper spirituality.
Well, and certainly you and other scientists are concerned about maybe not moral pollution of human beings, but the pollution that is accumulating, killing off the honeybees, and possibly could be harming human beings at the same time.
Well, there's a distance from nature that we feel increasingly in modern society. And when you connect with the bee world, it reminds us of the interactive importance of nature, that we are not here alone, that we are completely dependent on other organisms for our survival and for our thriving, as they are on us. And I think it's that connectivity that brings us into a deeper sense of spirituality with the bees.
Go to Steve in Blanchardville. Hello, Steve.
Hi. I was wondering if the guests can be a little bit more specific as to what pesticides are harming the bees. When we talk about pesticides, it falls into a lot of different categories like insecticides and herbicides. And from what I understand, the insecticides are the ones that are causing damage. And I bring this up only because I do a lot of prairie oak spanner restoration for my business. And unfortunately, one of the dirty sides of my business is using pesticides, which is mainly herbicides. you know, my goal is to increase pollinators. So I was wondering if he can touch on that at all.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I would say that herbicides are as damaging to bees as insecticides, but in a very different way. Insecticides, many of them, of course, bees are insects, and insecticides, many of them kill bees outright. And they create this low-level problem for bees with their immune systems. So certainly many insecticides are problematic for bees, including, by the way, some of the pesticides that beekeepers put inside their own hives in order to combat bee pests and diseases. But herbicides are incredibly effective at eliminating weeds, and weeds are absolutely critical for bees because they produce those diverse nectars and pollen that bees are dependent on. So when you clean a field with herbicides and you get rid of those weeds, you're essentially getting rid of the bees without killing them directly. You're getting rid of their food source. It'd be like taking away all of our supermarkets, you know, and all of a sudden we wouldn't have food out there. That's what herbicides do to the bees.
Thank you, Steve, for the call. Barbara in Madison is with us now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I understand that there are commercial companies that load bees onto semis and drive them around the country to pollinate crops for farmers, and that's one of the problems. And nobody seems to know that this is happening because they're sometimes transmitting diseases from place to place. I was wondering if your guest knows anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Mark Winston?
Oh yeah. It's, you know, it's a marvelous example of human ingenuity. Over 60% of the honeybee colonies in the United States, about 1.6 million colonies, are put on trucks every year and moved from place to place to pollinate crops. And they're moved sometimes 4 or 5 or 6 times. You know, 700 or 800 colonies might go onto a big semi-truck and be hauled from Florida to California to pollinate almonds and then move somewhere for plums or pears or apples and move up to North Dakota for sunflowers. And it's an extremely mobile industry. And while at the same time that we can marvel at our human ingenuity of creating such an incredibly interesting management system, it's also quite harmful for bees. Moving them around does spread pests and diseases. It's also quite stressful on the bees. And they're being moved into areas where there's nothing blooming but a single crop. And so it creates a nutritional stress for them. It's an incredible industry. And, you know, while at the same time we marvel at the ingenuity of beekeepers who are able to accomplish that, we have to recognize that it's another example of how maybe we're managing the world around us a little bit too intensively and that management is coming back to bite us.
We are talking with Mark Winston, who is a bee biologist and the author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. We're talking about the decline of the honeybee population, the threats facing the honeybee and wild bee populations, and what's needed to save our bees and also save our crops. And what lessons humans can take from what's happening to bees. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question or a concern, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I wanted to ask you, Mark Winston, besides the canary in the coal mine analogy and that we need to be concerned about the cumulative effect of pesticides and insecticides and herbicides in us as we are seeing that it's hurting the bees, what else can we learn from bees? What are the other lessons from the hive?
Well, you know, bees are getting a lot of attention for the bad news stories, but there's a lot of good news things about bees. That I have learned a tremendous amount from bees about collaboration. Bees have these enormously complicated societies. At the pinnacle of
social evolution is. We are at another pinnacle of social evolution. And they choose to, well, they've evolved to collaborate with each other more than compete. So you have individuals whose primary objective is the good of the hive. And I think as we look around our own political systems, we see special interest groups that are considerably more interested in their own small spheres than they are in the overall good. And particularly during an election time in the United States, I think it's useful to step back and think a little bit about whether we have degenerated into a society that is pushing the interests of the few over a society that functions well like a bee society does, that is, in which the interests of the many are paramount. So I think there's a lot to be learned about collaboration and how to govern from watching the bees. You certainly don't see the situations in beehives that you find in the American political institutions. I mean, the U.S. Congress or the Madison State House would be, those are they are highly dysfunctional systems, the way they are working today compared to the way the kind of harmony that you find in a beehive.
So do we need to be a monarchy? Can I be queen for the Wisconsin State House? Is that what we have to have?
Well, bees are not a monarchy, actually.
Okay.
They do have a queen, but she does not rule in any way that we would be familiar with royalty. Bees are very, their governing systems are very decentralized. Each individual worker looks around for the things that need to be done, communicates intensely with the other workers about what they're doing and what tasks need to be happened, and then they make a lot of decisions. A bee colony is much more like a New England town meeting than it would be like a monarchy. So the lesson from bees is not to have a strong leader, but that it's to have a much more democratic system in which the leaders and special interest groups are not driving the system, but individual sense of responsibility to the community is really the driver.
Can you give us an example how bee society works, and so we can understand?
Sure. Well, bees have many tasks they need to do, as we do, in order to make the colony function. And they are always communicating intensely with each other through chemical communication, passing around pheromones, through sound, visual, doing dancing, some modes of communication that we only barely understand. They're very sensitive to electrical signals and magnetism and things that are really beneath our usual radar. And so they have all this information that's coming around. And the single bee is picking up signals about what needs to be done in the hive. And if, for example, she gets a signal from the young in the bee, the larvae, that they need feeding, her special glands that produce food will start to activate and produce more food. And that's in the process of other bees that are maybe a bit older, then get a signal that, well, in order to produce all this food, we need to go out there and forage a little more for pollen. And so the foraging force may switch its foraging interests away from nectar and flowers and towards pollen, which provides protein. So there's lots of feedback mechanisms in the hive telling each worker what needs to be done most immediately, and then they shift their workload in order to accomplish that.
Boy, and all the bees are cooperating. They're all working, doing their share. Or is there ever a lazy bum that needs to get his butt kicked?
All bees do their share. It's also a great lesson in the importance of the individual. Each individual bee does a tiny bit of work, and yet it's those tiny bits of work that accumulate into the very effective colony functioning. It's interesting that you use the word lazy, because there's another lesson we can learn from bees. We think of bees as being busy as a bee, but bees spend most of their time resting. They're not actually working all the time. They take downtime,
they have learned that being workaholics burns them out quickly and they die young. And they work as much as necessary, but they also spend time just resting when the workload doesn't require it. And we could learn quite a bit from that, too. We live in a very hyper-driven, overworked society in which relaxing has become something we recall from our ancestors that is no longer maybe such a good part of our own society. And we can learn from bees that taking that downtime provides us with the energy and the resilience to respond to the work that it really does need to be done.
That's great. We need to learn to take it easy when we can. Peggy in Shawano County is with us. Hello, Peggy.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
This is a great program. Thank you so much. I've learned so much already. I have to tell you of an experience. I had one old rose bush that wasn't doing very well, and I thought, well, I'll go to the garden store and I'll solve the problems. And sad to say, I bought a systemic fertilizer, anti-everything that would be harmful to a rose. But, of course, what I did was poisoned any pollinating critter that came anywhere near it because the blossoms were poisoned, too. When it's systemic, it's through the whole plant. And when I realized what I'd done, I had a great rose bush, but I was sick. So to make up for it, no, not really, not to make up for it, but I don't do that anymore, and I don't do most pesticides at all in my rural area, in my garden. I have a small prairie area, and I just can't tell you the difference because of the diversity of plants in this tiny area. When you walk into that area, it's humming with all kinds of things. There aren't any honeybee hives around me that I know of, but it's just humming with pollinating insects. So I decided to turn my way too big garden into partly a bee attractive spot. So I'm putting in plants, native plants, and any plant that's attractive to a bee, and in the hopes that I can make, you know, if we all do our tiny little part, right, maybe it'll help. So hopefully the wild bees and any honeybee in the area or anything that pollinates will have a little chance, a refuge of some sort.
That's
and they'll
so
find
nice.
It. I'm not worried.
That's nice, Peggy. And what about that, Mark? Is that going to help?
Oh, yeah. I mean, good for you, Peggy. People that have, all of us, have any access to habitat need to be thinking about the bees. I'm remembering a trip I took to the Central Valley of California in researching this book, in which I was going from almond orchard to almond orchard. And almond orchards are huge, you know, acre after acre of acre of nothing but almonds. And you walk through those, and except for the managed honeybees, you really don't see very many wild bees. And then I came across a particular grower who believes that it's important to enhance habitats for wild bees. And on his farm, unlike any of the others, he plants bee-friendly plants up and down the irrigation ditches, up and down roadways. He leaves cover crops underneath the orchards rather than killing them with herbicides. And as soon as you cross the boundary into his farm, all of a sudden, just like your experience, Peggy, the bees are humming. They're everywhere. It's not that hard. We've destroyed the habitats that bees live in, but we can also resurrect them. And there's a growing movement all across, not only the United States, but really all across the world, to return habitats to a much more healthy and diverse place. And when that's done, we find the beneficial organisms, not only bees, but many of the organisms that could be used to control pests and reduce pesticide use, thrive. And it's quite remarkable how quickly things come back, but we have to do it. And if we don't do it, we're going to stay in these large agricultural deserts that have very little living in them besides the plant that we're growing for food.
We are talking with Mark Winston. Mark is a bee biologist. He has been for 40 years. He is with the Simon Fraser University Professor in the Department of Biological Sciences, and he is the author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. If you have a question for him or a concern that you'd like to share, are you doing anything to save the bees? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about the plight of the honeybee and what we can learn about ourselves from honeybees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. He's told us about colony collapse disorder and other threats facing the bee population, the synergy that he thinks is behind the decline in bee populations, and what lessons bees can offer humans. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Russ in Seneca is with us now. Hello, Russ.
Morning, guys. I'm calling because I was. I heard the guest earlier kind of clarify to another caller that both herbicides and pesticides are detrimental to the bee populations. And just to give you my background, I work full time off the farm as an engineer, but I am also a commercial grain farmer now. We sold our beef cows, so we're just doing commercial grain these days. And I use GMO seeds, and I use herbicides, obviously, to control weeds and maximize yields. And I do that primarily because all of the data, including that which comes from our UW Extension, indicates that doing so produces the maximum yields with the least amount of environmental impacts in terms of energy used per acre. So, and understanding what those impacts are to bees, I am wondering, I guess, how the guests would balance the trade-off. If we abandon these practices, our yields are certain to go down, which will certainly drive food prices very high if this mentality is embraced large scale. And so there's massive impacts, and I'm just curious how he would propose we reconcile those impacts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you need to look at the source of a lot of those data. Most data that have to do with yield and impact and effects of agricultural chemicals come from agricultural chemical companies. They're not conducted by any independent research. It's really very much driven by the industry. Where there have been studies of more sustainable farming, in which you're reducing pesticide use, reducing herbicide use, using more natural fertilizers, using good crop rotation, having more polycultural systems in which you're growing a number of crops simultaneously, invariably they show better yields. For example, we did a study up in Alberta, Canada, on canola, in which a more sustainable system in which farmers were actually planting less crops but allowing some habitat for bees pretty much almost tripled the yield just because of the increase in pollinators. And I think as we accumulate more evidence about alternative farming systems, we're going to continue to discover that, in fact, they are not detrimental to food production. They are not detrimental to farmers' income, but on the contrary, they're equal or better than the current mass input systems that we have.
Next, we go to Terry in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, Terry.
Good morning. I have some native prairie as well and build houses for orchard mason bees, so lots of native pollinators, and I've been interested in getting a couple hives of honeybees, but my concern is that I may spread some of these mites that are so damaging to honeybees, to my native bees, and maybe possibly also some diseases that might come in with them. I live in sort of an isolated area.
Generally not a worry. Most diseases, the mites are specific to honeybees, and they don't affect other bees. And most of the bee diseases are also fairly specific to honeybees. And I would, as long as you're only getting a few honeybee colonies, you're probably not going to have any effect on the wild bee populations.
I know that you also write about this relatively new phenomenon of people raising bees in urban settings. I know the city of Madison allows residents to obtain urban beekeeping licenses. what role will urban bees play in the future of bees?
Well, urban bees are fascinating for quite a few reasons. One is how well they do in cities, and the other is they're part of this really growing urban food revolution, in which more and more of our food is being grown in cities. This is a phenomenon outside of North America, which is quite common. There's a lot of food being grown in cities all over the world, and North America is starting to catch up. And bees are helping us become aware of the potential for growing food extremely locally, you know, literally in our own backyards and cities. There's a big project in Milwaukee called, I think it's called Growing Power, in which they're growing enough food to feed about 10,000 people in the city. And it's quite a reminder of the potential cities have for growing food.
Let's go to Bernard in Madison next. Hi, Bernard.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with the amount of honey produced by a beehive. Do they make enough honey for their needs, such that if you harvest the honey, wouldn't that create a deficiency in relation to their to what they made the honey for to begin with?
Interesting.
Well, the way we manage bees is to create colonies that are larger than they normally would be in the wild, and that allows them to produce surplus honey. What beekeepers do often is, and I'm not sure this is the best practice, but they take all the honey from the hive, and then they feed the bees back sugar, and that gives them the energy, the stores to live through the wintertime. But a much better practice is to manage the hive so they produce enough honey to share, so that you're leaving the bees with the 50 or 60 pounds of honey that they need to survive the winter, and you're also taking off 50 or 60 or 100 pounds of honey that you want as your crop. So keeping that balance between what we're taking from the bees and what we want to harvest is the best model for beekeeping.
Talk a little bit more about bees and their honey. Why do bees eat honey? It seems like that's a lot of work to produce honey.
A huge amount of work, but bees only have two food sources. The nectar and flowers, which they turn into honey, is their carbohydrate source. That's where they get their sugars and their energy. And pollen is their protein source. And from these two very simple products of plants, bees are able to meet all of their nutritional needs.
So then they make the honey for what?
Well, the honey provides them with their energy, and it's their overwintering food. So they store the honey, and then they feed off it during the wintertime. That provides the energy that they can use to keep warm. They create very tight clusters inside the hive around the honey, and they eat the honey, shiver to generate heat, and they'll do that all through the winter. The inside of the colony will be kept at pretty tropical temperatures by the bees just shivering and keeping warm. If you put your hand inside a hive in the middle of the winter, it'll feel like you're in an overheated room because that's how warm they keep it. Mm-hmm. And it takes the honey to give them the energy to do that.
Larry on Facebook asks, queen bees used to be viable for up to 3 or 4 years. Nowadays, we're lucky to keep a queen alive for a year. What's going on?
Well, a few things. I'm not sure queen breeding is as good as it used to be in creating good long-lived queens. The queens are very susceptible to pesticides and diseases as well. And just as bees are, the worker bees are having trouble surviving, the queens are similarly challenged by pesticides that they're confronted with in the colony. So I hear a lot from beekeepers that the queens just aren't living as long as they used to. And I think these same things that are affecting the overall colony are influencing the queen bees.
Joan in Rudolph is with us. Hi, Joan.
Hi. My question is relative to the cost of, in your answer to the GMO guy, You know, yeah, it is proven still with independent studies that if you produce food without the use of pesticides, it's much productive. But the other part of that answer is, okay, so if we still use these GMO products and other pesticides, we do away with the bee pollinators, what happens to the crops that depend on those? Isn't the cost going to skyrocket for the consumer? And isn't that another part of that answer? There is a cost, yeah. So who's paying that cost? It's going to be the consumer paying more for the products that depend on bees because we're still eliminating. And also the monocultures that are producing the crops are further, the sustainability of the planet's further degrading. So, yeah, there is a cost, and it's the chemicals that are causing that cost.
Yeah. Well, very much. I think it depends on who you want to pay the cost. And the ecological services that bees provide are just not factored into any economic equations. And when you start factoring them in, you realize that enhancing bees is a way of driving down other farm costs. Now, the economic analyses of farming are really frightening. The costs for farmers just keep going up because of the kind of corporate seeds and fertilizers and pesticides and the inputs that farmers have to use in current agricultural systems are really becoming financially unsustainable. And yet when you start backing off on those inputs and allowing more ecological management, more sustainable kinds of farming, not even organic farming necessarily, but just farming with reduced inputs, farmers see their yields maintained or they see their yields going up. And they see their costs going down. So it certainly makes good economic sense to be exploring other systems beyond the mass input agricultural systems that we have today.
Well, I know you've spent considerable time handling and studying bees. I'll confess at the end here that I used to have quite a fear of all bees. I'm much, much, much better now. Still don't like those hornets and wasps. But do we have any reason to be afraid of bees?
Bees are usually fairly gentle, and you may get stung occasionally around bees, but they're not nearly as aggressive as people think they are. You know, there are some people that have severe allergic reactions, and they certainly need to worry. But rather than fear bees, I think we can learn quite a bit from being around them. I know I've learned my whole sense of being present in the world comes from working in apiaries, and I actually have the opposite feeling around bees than you do. It's, I feel calm in the presence of bees. I feel a sense of order, a sense of community, a sense of collegiality and collaboration, and just a real heightened focus of interacting with the environment around me. And I think it's better to explore and embrace that rather than the unusual situation where you might get stung.
Yeah, I think my fear stemmed from getting stung as a child by a bee. But again, I don't hold it against them now. So can we, in our final minute, can we save bees?
Absolutely. I remain incredibly optimistic about our future. We know enough about what's harming bees to devise good ways to save them. And in the process, if we reduce pesticide use, create more diverse habitats, pay more attention to the collaborative and collegial aspects of bees, we too will benefit. We're not going to lose. We're going to maintain our food production, and we're going to have a heightened sense of our own dependence on the natural world around us, which is something we tend to lose sight of. And bees can teach us that lesson.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Winston is author of Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. Thanks very much to Christy Taylor and to Brianne Chasseau for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, it's another edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will offer information and advice, answers to your personal finance questions. That's On Your Money every week on Tuesdays. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.